How did you know all this?
I stood online for 25 minutes to call Larry, just to hear his voice. He almost always picked up.
Hey, babe, I'm so glad you called. I miss you.
Listen, my parents want to come see you this Friday.
That's fantastic.
His parents, Carol and Lou, had come up to see me once before, but they had gotten stuck behind a highway accident for hours and had arrived 15 minutes before visiting hours were over, with Larry overheated and them flustered.
Yeah, they're going to do some foliage stuff too, so I actually told them to go ahead and book the inn where they want to stay.
I can't come then. I've got a big meeting.
Panic.
What? What do you mean? You're not going to come with them?
I can't, baby. It doesn't matter, it's you they want to see.
In no time at all, the infuriating click on the line was telling me my 15 minutes were up and the prison system was going to end the call. I went to see the Italian twins.
My future in-laws are coming to see me, without Larry.
This cracked them up.
They're going to make you an offer you can't refuse.
Pop didn't think it was funny.
You should feel lucky they want to see you. They're good people. What's wrong with you girls?
I loved visits with my family. My mother, my father, each provided a calm, loving, reassuring presence at the folding card tables that reinforced the fact that this would all be over eventually and I would be able to resume my life. My kid brother, the artist, showed up for his first visit in an Italian suit he'd bought in a thrift store.
I didn't know what to wear to prison, he said.
When my aunt brought my three young cousins to see me, little Elizabeth wrapped her arms around my neck and her skinny little legs around my waist, and a lump rose in my throat and I almost lost it as I hugged her back. They were all blood relatives. They had to love me, right? I had always gotten along well with Larry's parents, but I was still really nervous about a three-hour prison visit. So nervous that I let someone talk me into a haircut in the prison salon, which looked sort of choppy and uneven. It's a miracle I didn't end up with bangs, that week's jailhouse beauty trend. On Friday, I made myself as presentable as humanly possible, short of setting my hair in rollers. And then there they were, looking mildly nervous themselves. Once we had settled in at our card table, I was relieved to have them there. Carol had millions of questions, and Lou needed a tour of the vending machines. I think he was trying to gauge the likelihood of his own survival if he were standing in my shoes. And for Lou, that means food. If that was true, his prospects were dim as we peered at the anemic-looking chicken wings in the old-fashioned automat-style vending machine. The time flew by, and we didn't even miss Larry. Carol and Lou were cheery and so normal, it felt almost like they were chatting in their kitchen in New Jersey. I was grateful that they had taken the time to see me, and at the end of the visit, I waved until they disappeared from sight. That night, I thought about my own mother. I worried about Mom. She was supportive, positive, dedicated, but the stress of my imprisonment must have been terrible for her, and I knew that she worried about me all the time. Her forthrightness in the face of the disaster into which I had dragged my family had been impressive. She had informed her co-workers and her friends about my situation. I knew intellectually that she had a support system out there, but a great deal of the weight of helping me get through prison was clearly falling on her shoulders. How could she look so happy to see me every week? I searched her face at our next visit and saw only that maternal classic, unconditional love. Afterward, Pop asked me, "How was your visit with your mom?" I told her I was worried about the strain my mess was causing. Pop listened and then asked me,
"So your mother, is she like you?"
"What do you mean, Pop?"
"I mean, is she outgoing? Is she funny? Does she have friends?"
"Well, sure. I mean, she's the reason I am the way I am."
"Sweetie, if you two are the same, then she's going to be okay."
As soon as Martha Stewart was dispatched to West Virginia, the Danbury camp was suddenly open, and a rush of new inmates arrived to fill all the empty beds.
Any influx of new prisoners means problems, as new personalities are injected into the mix, and scarcity places more demand on both staff and inmates. It meant longer chow lines, longer laundry lines, more noise, more intrigue, and more chaos.
"Say what you will about Butorsky, Bunky, but at least he was all about the rules," said Natalie. "Finn, he ain't about nothing."
Over the summer, daily discipline in the camp had been largely non-existent, and the low population had counteracted this in a pleasant, go-about-your-business-and-don't-bother-anyone vibe. But now, with the place suddenly full of new wackos and lax oversight, plus the ongoing contraband cigarette drama, the camp was off the chain. The cigarette situation was particularly irritating. Far more people were trying to get contraband from the outside now, with occasionally comic results. There were only a handful of ways to get outside contraband. A visitor could bring it in, or, rumor had it, the warehouse was a source. Or someone from the outside could drop it on the edge of the prison property where there was a public road. The recipient had to either work for the grounds department or have an accomplice in grounds who would grab the package. Contraband included things like cigarettes, drugs, cell phones, and lingerie. I was surprised to hear one day that Bianca and Lump Lump had been taken to the SHU. Bianca was a pretty young girl with blue-black hair and wide eyes. She looked like a voluptuous World War II pinup. She was not the sharpest tool in the shed, it was a standing joke around the camp, but she was a good girl. Her family and boyfriend came to see her every week, and everyone liked her. Lump Lump, her friend, was pretty much as you would expect given her nickname, in both appearance and personality. They both worked for the safety department in CMS, which was a do-nothing job. "You're not going to believe this story," Tony told Rosemary and me. The town driver usually had the inside scoop early on. "These two dumb bunnies had somebody outside drop a package for them. They go to pick it up during CMS work hours, and then they've got the stuff with them, and they're walking by the FCI lobby, and they remember that they're supposed to do the monthly safety inspection in there. So they go into the lobby with their contraband, probably looking like the guilty idiots they are, and Officer Riley, for some reason, decides to pat them down. So of course she finds the contraband. Get this. Cartons of cigarettes and vibrators. They were smuggling dildos." It was generally taken as hilarious, but it would be the last we saw of Bianca and Lump Lump. Smuggling contraband was a very serious shot, a breach of security, and whenever they got out of the SHU, they would stay down on the compound. October 19th, 2004. Piper Kerman, Reg number 11187-424. Federal Prison Camp, Danbury, Connecticut, 06811. Dear Ms. Kerman, I would like to thank you for your assistance in preparing the warden's house for my arrival. Your eagerness to please and enthusiasm for the project made my arrival to Danbury a pleasant one. Your good workmanship was evident and is to be commended. Your efforts are greatly appreciated. Sincerely, W.S. Willingham, Warden.
"Huh. Maybe this one's going to be better," said Pop. "The best ones are the ones who are for the inmates. The last one, Daboo, she was just a politician. Smile in your face, acts like she feels your pain, but she's not gonna do shit for you. When they come from a men's institution like Willingham, they're usually better. Less bullshit. We'll see."
I was sitting on a footstool in her cube where I had brought the typewritten note from the new warden. I'd just received it at mail call. Pop had been through a lot of wardens, and I knew she'd be able to tell me if this was as surprising as I found it.
"Piper." I knew that tone of voice.
Pop was never at mail call because she was still in the kitchen cleaning up after dinner. She worked harder than any other person in the camp. She was up and in the kitchen at 5 most mornings, and she usually worked serving all 3 meals in addition to the cooking. Her 50-year-old body was riddled with aches and pains, and the institution periodically sent her out to Danbury Hospital for epidural shots in her back. I nagged her to take days off. She wasn't required to work so many hours. "Yes, Pop," I smiled from the footstool. I was going to make her ask, "How about just a little foot rub?" I don't remember exactly how Pop had first gotten me to give her a foot massage, but it had become a regular ritual several times a week. She would sit on her bed post-shower in her sweats, and I would sit facing her with a clean towel across my lap. I would get a handful of commissary lotion and firmly grasp a foot. I gave a very firm foot massage, and she would occasionally yelp when I dug a knuckle in hard. My services were a great source of amusement in A dorm. Women would come by and chit-chat with Pop while I worked on her feet, occasionally asking, "How do I get one of those?" I was, of course, out of bounds and also breaking the prohibition against inmates touching each other. But the regular camp officers extended special considerations to Pop. One evening, while I was rubbing her feet, a substitute officer up from the FCI stopped dead in his tracks at the doorway of Pop's cube. He was a shaggy, craggy-looking white guy with a mustache. "Popovich?" It sounded more like a question than a warning. I ducked my head, making no eye contact.
"Mr. Ryan, it's this foot of mine. I hurt it. She's just helping get the cramp out. Happens all the time since I'm on my feet all day. Officer Maple allows it. Is it okay?"
Pop was all charm when it came to interacting with COs.
"Whatever. I'm gonna keep walking," he thudded away.
I looked at Pop. Maybe I better beat it?
"Him? I known him for years, from down the compound. He's all right. Don't stop."
The American League Championship was so hotly contentious that year, I could barely stand to watch the games. The tension of being a Red Sox fan as they battled back from 0-3 made my stomach hurt, and my surroundings didn't make it any easier. The running joke in the camp was that half of the population of the Bronx was residing in Danbury, and of course they were all ferocious Yankee fans. But the Red Sox had plenty of partisans too. A significant percentage of the white women were from Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, and the always suspect border state of Connecticut. Daily life was usually radically peaceful in the camp, but the very obvious racial divide between Yankees and Sox fans made me nervous. I remembered the riot at UMass in 1986 after the Mets defeated the Sox in the World Series, when black Mets fans were horribly beaten. I'm not sure what kind of a brawl we could have come up with, though. The most hardcore Sox fans in the joint were a clique of middle-aged, middle-class white ladies, whose ringleader was nicknamed Bunny. For some reason, most of them worked for the grounds department and CMS. During all of the pennant fever, they went about their work cutting lawns and raking leaves, serenading each other. "Johnny Damon, how I love him. He's got something I can't resist. But he doesn't even know that I exist. Johnny Damon, how I want him, how I tingle when he passes by. Every time he says hello, my heart begins to fly. Other fellows call me up for a date, but I just sit and wait. I'd rather concentrate on Johnny Damon." Carmen DeLeon, the biggest Yankee fan of all, straight from Hunts Point, gave me the hairy eyeball.
"Those are your peoples," she pointed out acidly.
I glared, but I was too nervous to even talk smack, not because I was scared of Carmen, but because I was worried about jinxing the Sox. The year before, Larry and I had gathered a roughneck band of Sox fans in our apartment in the East Village for Game 7. And based on our lead in the sixth inning, we felt confident enough to venture out to a local bar in the hopes that we could celebrate our victory loudly and publicly there, in the face of the vile, overbearing Yanks fans who had made our lives miserable for our entire lives. Instead, we sat wretchedly nursing overpriced beers through extra innings as Martinez inexplicably stayed in, and Red Sox Nation's hopes and dreams collapsed with the team.
"I'll tell you what,"
said Carmen, puffing out her already considerable chest like a peacock.
If the Red Sox are in the World Series, I'm gonna root for them. That's a promise.
When pigs fly, I thought gloomily. When the Yankees went down in flames after a 7-game series, and the Red Sox were facing the St. Louis Cardinals in the World Series, the crowds in the TV room were actually smaller. But Carmen DeLeon was there front and center, grinning and rooting for the Sox. And the series was surreally easy, a 4-game sweep. I couldn't trust it. After each victory, I felt my anxiety mount. At the end of Game 4, after the final out by the Cards, I started to shake uncontrollably. Rose Marie, also a lifelong Sox fan, grabbed my knee.
Are you okay?
Carmen looked at me in amazement.
Piper's crying.
I was amazed too. I do love the Red Sox, but my reaction shocked even me. I calmed down enough to watch the post-game celebration dry-eyed. But alone in the bathroom between B and C dorms, I started to cry again. I went outside to stare at the half-cloaked moon and cry alone, out loud. Huge, shuddering sobs. I wasn't crying because I wished I was home celebrating, but I was completely taken aback at the level of my own emotion. I had joked that I had to do hard time in order to break the curse so the Red Sox could win. And now I felt that there was some strange truth to that. The world I knew had changed right there in the bottom of the ninth. Chapter 15. Some Kind of Way. The garage girls liked to hang out in the visiting room together in the evenings during the week. I was chilling with them, surrounded by prisoners who were crocheting industriously, watching Fear Factor with their headsets on or just talking. Pom Pom was doing some sort of art project with colored pencils, probably a birthday card. Suddenly, a woman rushed into the room, wild-eyed.
The CEO is destroying A-Dorm!
We followed her out into the hall where a crowd was gathering. The new CEO on duty that night was a pleasant, seemingly mild-mannered, and very big young guy. He, like a huge number of the prison guards, was former military. These folks would finish their commitment to the armed services and have several years in on a federal pension, so they'd end up working for the BOP. Sometimes they'd tell us about their military careers. Mr. Maple had been a medic in Afghanistan. The CEO on duty that night was fresh from Iraq and had just started work at the prison. It was rumored that he had been stationed in Fallujah, where the fighting had been brutal all spring. That night, someone from A-Dorm had been giving him trouble, some sort of back talk, and something snapped. Before anyone really knew what was going on, he was down in A-Dorm pulling the contents of the cubicles apart, yanking things off the walls and ripping bedding off mattresses and turning them over. We were scared. 200 prisoners alone with one guard having a psychotic break. Someone went outside and flagged down the perimeter truck, which got help from down the hill. The young soldier left the building and A-Dorm residents started to put their cubes back together. Everyone was rattled. The next day, one of the lieutenants came up from the FCI and apologized to A-Dorm, which was unprecedented. We did not see the young CEO again. Newly Zen, thanks to Yoga Janet, well-fed by Pop, and now proficient in concrete mixing as well as rudimentary electrical work, I felt as if I were making the most of this prison thing. If this was the worst the feds were going to throw at me, no problem. So when I called my father on the prison payphone to talk about the Red Sox, he told me,
"Piper, your grandmother is not doing well."
Southern, proper, and bird-like, but possessing a stern, formidable personality. My grandmother had been a constant figure in my life. A child of West Virginia who grew up in the Depression with two brothers and then raised four sons, she had little idea what to do with a young girl, her eldest grandchild, and I was scared of her. I remained in awe of her, although as I got older, we developed an easier rapport. She spoke frankly to me in private about sex, feminism, and power.
She and my grandfather were dumbstruck and horrified by my criminal misadventures, and yet they never let me forget that they loved me and worried about me. The one thing that I feared most about prison was that one of them would die while I was there. I pleaded with my father on the payphone. She would be fine. She would get better. She would be there when I came home. He didn't argue back, just said, "Write her." I was on a regular schedule of writing short, cheery updates to my grandparents, reassuring them that I was fine and couldn't wait to see them when I got home. Now, I sat down to write a different kind of letter, one that tried to convey how much she meant to me, how much she had taught me, how much I wanted to emulate her rigor and rectitude, how much I loved her and missed her. I couldn't believe that I had screwed up so badly to be in this place when she needed me, when she was sick and maybe dying. Immediately after posting the letter, I asked the camp secretary for a furlough request form. "Were you raised by your grandmother?" she asked brusquely. When I said no, she told me there was no point in giving me the form. I would never be granted a furlough for a grandparent. I sharply said that I was furlough eligible and would make the request anyway.
"Suit yourself," she snapped.
Pop gently counseled me that in fact I had no chance of getting furloughed, even for a funeral, unless it was my parent, my child, or maybe my sibling, and that she did not want me to get my hopes up.
"I know it's not right, honey. That's just how they do things."
I had seen many other prisoners suffer through the illnesses of their loved ones, and had felt helpless watching them when the worst would come, when they had to confront not only their grief, but also the personal failure of being in prison and not with their families. I was not festive that Halloween. I was feeling some kind of way, like I had been walloped in the gut with a sledgehammer. There was no escape from the festivities of the 200-plus women I was living with, cheek by jowl every day. The women love their holidays. Halloween in prison was odd, I had been told. Could it be odder than anything else here? How would one create a costume with such limited and colorless resources as we had at our disposal? Earlier that day, I had seen some idiotic cat masks made from manila folders. Besides, I was in no mood for anything, let alone handing out candy. The faithful could be heard from halfway across B dorm, "Trick or treat!" Trying to focus on my book, I stayed in my bunk. Then Delicious spoke to me from the doorway of my cube. "Trick or treat, P.I. Piper." I had to smile. Delicious was dressed as a pimp, clad in an all-white outfit she had put together somehow using her kitchen uniform and inside-out sweatpants. She had a cigar and a cluster of hoes around her. This included a bunch of the M&M-lets, but also Fran, the motor-mouthed Italian grandma, at 78, the oldest woman in the camp. The hoes had tried to sexy themselves up, hiking sweat shorts high and t-shirt necklines low, but mostly relying on makeup that was garish even by prison standards. Fran had a long cigarette holder and headband she had made from paper, and heavy rouge. She looked like an ancient flapper.
"Come on, Piper, trick or treat," Delicious demanded. "Smell my feet, give me something sweet to eat, you know?"
I never kept candy in my cube. I tried to muster up a big smile to let them know I appreciated their creativity.
"I guess trick, Delicious. I'm flat out of sweetness."
I began to stalk the prison officials who might have some say in whether I ever saw my grandmother again. One was the always absent temporary unit manager, Bubba, who could tell you to go fuck yourself in the most pleasant possible way. My counselor, Finn, another BOP lifer, was an indifferent jokester who was quick with an insult and never did his paperwork. But he liked me because I was blonde and blue-eyed and had a tight ass, as he would mutter under his breath. He very kindly offered to let me call my grandmother from his office. The hospice number was not on the approved list in the prison phone system, so I could not call from the payphones. She sounded exhausted and astonished to hear my voice on the line. When I hung up the phone, I dissolved in sobs. I rushed out of his office and down to the track.
I returned to my old lonely ways. I shut myself off and kept quiet, determined to gut out this worst-case scenario alone. Anything else would be an admission to the world that the feds had succeeded in bringing me down, lower than my knees, flat on my face, that I couldn't survive my imprisonment unscathed. How could I admit that the all-American girls' force field of stoicism and self-reliance and do unto others and keep smiling wasn't working, wasn't keeping pain and shame and powerlessness away? From a young age, I had learned to get over, to cover my tracks emotionally, to hide or ignore my problems in the belief that they were mine alone to solve. So when exhilarating transgressions required getting over on authority figures, I knew how to do it. I was a great bluffer. And when common everyday survival in prison required getting over, I could do that too. This is what was approvingly described by my fellow prisoners as street smarts, as in, you wouldn't think it to look at her, but Piper's got street smarts. It wasn't just my peers who applauded this trait. The prison system mandates stoicism and tries to crush any genuine emotion. But everyone, jailers and prisoners alike, is still crossing boundaries left and right. My deep contempt for Levy was not only because I didn't like the way she put herself above others, but also because she was the opposite of stoic. Nobody likes a crybaby. In the following weeks, I walked around in a state of tightly leashed fury and despair. I kept to myself, civil within the requirements of prison society, but unwilling to chat or joke. Fellow prisoners, offended, sniffed that I must be feeling some kind of way, as I was not my usual optimistic self. Then someone in the know would whisper to them that my grandmother was very ill. Suddenly, I was the recipient of kind words, sympathetic advice, and prayer cards. And all those things did indeed remind me that I was not alone, that every woman living in that building was in the same rotten boat. I thought about one woman whose face had been a mask of pain upon the news of her mother's death. She had rocked silently, her face frozen in a howl as her friend wrapped her arms around her shoulders and rocked with her, in violation of the physical contact rules. I also remembered Roland, an upright Caribbean woman whose staunchness I admired. Roland would tell you straight up that prison saved her life. "I would be dead in a ditch for sure, the way I was living," she told me. She had done her bid with grace. She worked hard, didn't mess with other people, had a smile for the occasion, and asked no one for anything. A short while before Roland was to go home, her brother died. She was stoic and quiet and received permission for a half-day furlough to attend his funeral. But when her family members arrived at Danbury to pick her up, they drove a different car than the one registered in her paperwork. And that was it. She was sent back up to the camp from R&D, and her family was sent away. A few weeks later, she was released. The heartlessness, the pettiness, the foolishness of the situation was the talk of the camp. Contrarians pointed out that you had to assume that the feds would thwart you brutally given the chance, and that such mistakes were avoidable, but everyone's hearts ached collectively for her. Pop sat me down for a talk. "Look, honey, you are eating yourself up. I am gonna tell you, when my father was dying, I was out of my head, so I know how you feel. But listen to me, these bastards, as far as they're concerned, you got nothing coming to you. You think if you were getting a furlough, you wouldn't know it by now. Sweetie, you need to call your grandma on the phone. You need to write to her. You need to think about her a lot. But you cannot let these fuckers make you bitter. You're not a bitter person, Piper. It's not in your nature. Don't let them do it to you. Come here, honey." Pop hugged me hard, squashing me to her big, scented jewels. I knew she was right. I felt a tiny bit better. Still, I haunted the administrative offices, which were almost always empty. God knows what those people were doing. I wrote letters home and sat in my bunk with my photo album, staring at my grandmother's smile and her hairdo, the same Babe Paley set she had worn since the 1950s. The M&M-lets would come by to see me in my cube, then wander away, frustrated that they couldn't cheer me up. As the air got colder and Veterans Day passed, I checked in with my father every day by payphone. She was holding stable. Would I be able to get the furlough? Nervous that I would run out of phone minutes. I thought about praying, something I was certainly not practiced at doing. Fortunately, several people offered to do it for me, including Sister. That had to count extra, right? I wasn't inclined to formal prayer, but I was less skeptical about faith than I had been when I entered prison. On a late September day, I had been sitting behind a dorm at the picnic table with Gisella. She was my coworker in the construction shop, as well as the bus driver, and was one of the sweetest, kindest, gentlest women I've ever met, delicate and ladylike, and yet no simp, no Pollyanna. I can't remember ever hearing Gisella raise her voice, and given that she was the CMS bus driver, this was pretty amazing. Gisella was also graceful and lovely, her face a perfect pale brown oval, big brown eyes, long wavy hair. She was from the Dominican Republic but had lived in Massachusetts for years, not in the neighborhoods I knew well, but we shared some common ground. Her two kids were waiting for her there, in the care of an elderly woman named Noni Delgado, whom Gisella called her angel. On this particular day, Gisella and I were talking about her upcoming release. Of course, she was nervous. She was nervous about finding work. She was nervous about what her husband would do when she got out. He was in the DR, and they had what sounded like a tempestuous and tortured relationship. Gisella said she didn't want to reunite with him, but he sounded like a person who was difficult to resist, and of course they had children together. I knew that Gisella had no money and many responsibilities, and that she faced a massive number of unknown but looming challenges. But while she was quick to acknowledge that she was nervous, she also exhibited the peacefulness at her core, the loving calmness that made her the kind of person to whom everyone was drawn. And then she started to talk about God. Normally, professions of faith or discussions of religion in prison would win eye-rolling and a quick exit from me. I believed that everyone should be able to practice according to their own preferences and beliefs, but an awful lot of pilgrims in prison seem to be making it up as they go along, in silly ways, wearing a contraband napkin on their head 1 month when they're practicing Islam, and then appearing in the Buddhist meditation circle the next, after realizing that they could duck out of work for this new brand of religious observance. Couple that with a pretty reliable volume of ignorance about the rest of the world's faiths. Well, the Jews did kill Jesus, everyone knows that. And I generally didn't want any part of it. Gisella wasn't talking about religion or church or even Jesus, though. She was talking about God. And when she talked about God, she looked so happy. She spoke so freely and so easily about how God had helped her through all the struggles in her life, especially the years she had spent in prison. How she knew that God loved her completely and watched over her and gave her the peace of mind, the good sense, the clarity to be a good person even in a bad place. She said that she trusted God to help her by sending her angels like Noni Delgado to care for her children and good friends when she most needed them to help her survive prison. She glowed while she talked calmly and quietly about God and how much his love had given her. I was startled to feel so moved by what Gisella had to say, and I listened quietly. Some of her beliefs weren't stated all that differently from the scuttlebutt I had heard from the holy rollers in the camp, but their protestations of faith were imbued with the need for redemption. Jesus loves me even if I'm a bad person, even if no one else does. Gisella already knew about love. She was talking about an unshakable faith that gave her real strength and that she had carried for a long time. She wasn't talking about repentance or forgiveness, only love. What Gisella was describing to me was an exquisitely intimate and happy love. I thought it was the most compelling description of faith that I had ever heard. I wasn't about to grab a Bible. Nor was our conversation about me or my choices in any way. It was food for thought. I had long recognized that faith helped people understand their relationship to their community. In the best cases, it helped women in Danbury focus on what they had to give instead of what they wanted. And that was a good thing. So for all my scoffing at holy rollers, was it such a bad thing if faith helped someone understand what others needed from them, rather than just thinking about themselves? In prison, for the first time I understood that faith could help people see beyond themselves. Not into the abyss, but into the street, into the mix, to offer what was best about themselves to others. I grew to this understanding by way of knowing people like Sister, Yoga Janet, Gisella, and even my holy roller pedicurist, Rose. Rose, chatting in the midst of a pedicure one day, told me what she had learned from her faith. I thought later that hers were the most powerful words a person could utter. "I've got a lot to give." I had added frustrations, and my methods for dealing with them met with obstacles at every turn. The track was now closed after the 4 p.m. count. After work, I would race back to the camp, change into my sneakers, and run furiously until count time, cutting it closer and closer and stressing out most of B dorm. I would look up from the far side of the track and see Jay frantically beckoning me, and I would run at top speed up the rickety steps and through C dorm to my cube, other prisoners urging me to hurry.
"Pipes, you gonna fuck up the 4 o'clock count? Get your ass sent to the SHU,"
Delicious admonished from the other side of B dorm.
"Bunky, you cutting it close,"
Natalie would shake her head. Best case, I was only getting in about 6 miles on a weekday. I tried to make it up on the weekend, running 10 miles around the quarter-mile track on Saturdays and Sundays. But that didn't help with my daily tides of stress and anxiety about things and people I could not control. So I started doing more yoga. Initial interest in keeping the yoga class going had surged a bit, but a number of the new adherents, Amy cursing and squealing with every pose, didn't last long. Gata still appeared occasionally to stretch beside me, crooning at me affectionately. But I didn't have any decent Spanish, or Janet's soothing yoga presence, and she never dozed off with me. Camilla would come and do a tape with me sometimes on the weekend, and she was still radiant good company and could arch into a backbend next to mine. But she was preoccupied with her impending departure to the drug program down the hill. It was mainly me and Rodney Yee. I got into the habit of rising at 5, checking carefully to be sure that the morning count was complete. Boots thudding, flashlight beams bobbing, keys sometimes jangling if the CO didn't care enough to hold them still. I'd stand silently in my cube, hoping to startle them and make them jump. Natalie would already be gone to the kitchen to bake. I would revel in the complete darkness of B dorm, listening to 48 other women breathe in a polyrhythm of deep sleep as I prepared the right measures of instant coffee, sugar, and Cremora. It was warm and peaceful in B dorm as I slithered through the warren of cubicles to the hot water dispenser. Occasionally, I would see someone else awake. We would nod or sometimes murmur to each other. Steaming mug in hand, I would slip out of the building into the bracing cold and down to the gym to commune with the VCR and Rodney. In the perfect privacy of the empty gym, my body would slowly awaken and warm on the cold rubber floor. My head and heart stayed calmer longer, and the value of Yoga Janet's teaching became clearer every day. I missed her terribly, and yet she had given me a gift that allowed me to cope without her. In the last 10 months, I had found ways to carve out some sense of control of my world, seizing some personal power within a setting in which I was supposed to have none. But my grandmother's illness sent that sense spinning away, showed me how much my choices 11 years earlier and their consequences had put me in the power of a system that would be relentless in its efforts to take things away. I could choose to assign very little value to the physical comforts I had lost. I could find the juice and flair in who and what was precious in my current surroundings. But nothing here could substitute for my grandmother. And I was losing her. On a gray afternoon, I was whipping around the track, pushing myself to keep at a 7-minute mile speed. Mrs. Jones had given me a digital wristwatch that she never used, and I paced myself relentlessly with it. The weather was crap. It was going to rain. Jay appeared at the top of the hill, gesturing to me urgently. I looked at the watch and saw that it was only 3:25, 35 minutes until count time. What did she want? I pulled off my earphones, annoyed. "What's up?" I shouted into the wind. "Piper! Little Janet wants you!" She beckoned me up again. If little Janet wanted something, she should bring her young ass down here to the track to talk to me, unless something was wrong. Sudden panic pushed me up the stairs to Jay. "What is it? Where is she?" "She's in her cube. Come on." I strode along with Jay, tense. She didn't look like disaster had struck, but Jay was so used to disaster that you couldn't always tell. We got to A-dorm quickly. Little Janet was sitting on her bunkie's bottom bed, and she looked okay. I looked around her cube. It was bare, and there was a box on the floor. "Are you okay?" I wanted to shake her for scaring me.
"Piper, I'm going home."
I blinked. What the hell was she talking about?
"What are you talking about, baby?"
I sat down on the bed, pushing a pile of paper aside. I thought she might have lost her rabbit-ass mind. She grabbed my hand.
"I got immediate release."
"What?" I looked at her, afraid to believe what she was saying. Nobody got immediate release. Prisoners put in motions that took months and months to wend their way through the legal system, and they always lost. Immediate release was like the Easter Bunny.
"Are you sure, sweetie?"
I grabbed both of her hands. "Did they confirm? Did they say for you to pack out?" I looked at her pile of stuff, and I looked at Jay, who was smiling a huge smile. Tony appeared in the doorway of the now crowded cube with her coat on, jingling the town driver keys in her hand.
"Are you ready, Janet?"
"Piper, can you believe this? It's incredible." I whooped. Not a scream, but more like a war whoop. And then I crushed little Janet in a bear hug, squeezing her as hard as I could and laughing. She was laughing too, in joy and disbelief. When I finally let her go, I put both hands on my head, trying to steady myself. I was staggered, as if it were me who was leaving. I stood up and sat down.
"Tell me everything, but hurry, you have to go. Tony, are they waiting for her in R&D?
"Yeah, but we gotta get her down there before the count, or she's gonna be stuck behind it."
Little Janet hadn't told a soul that she had a motion entered in court. Typical jailhouse circumspection. But she had won, and her 60-month sentence had been cut to the time served. 2 years. Her parents were on their way to pick up their little girl and bring her home to New York. We hustled her out of her cube and out the back door to where the white van was parked next to the chow hall. It was almost dusk. There were just a few of us. Everything was happening so fast, no one else knew what was up.
"Janet, I am so happy for you."
She hugged me, hugged Jay, and kissed her bunkie, Miss Mimi, a tiny old Spanish mommy. Then she climbed in next to Tony, and the van pulled away, up the incline to the main road that circled the FCI. We waved wildly. Little Janet was turned around in her seat, calling goodbye to us out the window, until the van crested the hill and turned right, out of sight. I kept watching for what seemed like many minutes after she had disappeared. Then I looked at Jay. Jay, who had 7 more years to do of a 10-year sentence. She put her arm around my shoulders and squeezed.
"You okay?"
she said. I nodded. I was more than okay. Then we turned back and helped Miss Mimi into the camp. I tried to share the indescribable miracle of little Janet's freedom with Larry, and he tried to cheer me up with news of our new home in Brooklyn. Larry had been house hunting while I was away, and many people on the outside found it astonishing that I was comfortable with him picking out a new home for me sight unseen. But not only was I grateful, I also trusted completely that he would find a great place for us to live. He bought an apartment for us in a lovely, tree-shaded neighborhood. Still, at the moment, it was a little difficult for either of us to grasp the other's good news. I was having trouble imagining owning anything more than a bottle of shampoo or living anywhere other than B-dorm, and I stared rather stupidly at the floor plan and paint chips he brought with him. I assured Larry that when I came home to him, I would be Ms. Fix-It in our new apartment with all my prison-acquired skills. On the way out, I scowled at the guard on duty. He was a pig, all hands. Before you could enter the visiting room, the guard stepped out to frisk you, to ensure that you were not bringing anything out with you to pass to your visitor. In fact, a guard could pat you down at any time if they suspected you had contraband on you. These pat-downs were delivered by both male and female guards and ran the gamut from perfunctory to full-out inappropriate. Most of the male guards made a great show of performing the absolute minimal frisk necessary, skimming their fingertips along your arms, legs, and waist in such a way that said, "Not touching, not touching, not really touching." They didn't want any suggestion of impropriety raised against them. But a handful of the male guards apparently felt no fear about grabbing whatever they wanted. They were allowed to touch the lower edge of our bras to make sure we weren't smuggling goodies in there. But were they really allowed to squeeze our breasts? Sometimes it was shocking who would grope you, like polite, fair, and otherwise upstanding Mr. Black, who did it in a businesslike way. Other male COs were brazen, like the short, red-faced young big mouth who asked me loudly and repeatedly, "Where are the weapons of mass destruction?" while he fondled my ass and I gritted my teeth. There was absolutely no payoff for filing a complaint. A female prisoner who alleges sexual misconduct on the part of a guard is invariably locked in the SHU in protective custody, losing her housing assignment, program activities, if there are any, work assignment, and a host of other prison privileges, not to mention the comfort of her routine and friends. The guards were not supposed to ask us personal questions, but this rule got broken all the time. Some of them were completely matter-of-fact about it. One day, while I was learning how to solder in the greenhouse with one of the cheerful plumbing officers, he posited a friendly, "What the hell are you in here for?" But for the guards who knew me better, I could tell this was a more disturbing question, one that some of them brooded over. One afternoon, alone in a pickup truck, another CMS officer turned to me intensely and said, "I just don't understand it, Piper. What is a woman like you doing here? This is crazy." I had already told him that I was doing time on a 10-year-old drug charge. He wanted the story badly, but it was more than clear to me that intimacy with a guard would be ruinous for me, or for any prisoner. It made no sense to share any of my secrets with him. On the weekend when the New York Marathon took place, I completed 13 miles on the quarter-mile track, my own private prison half marathon. The following weekend was unusually warm, beautiful, really, and I was enjoying my Sabbath ritual, Little Steven's Underground Garage, a 2-hour radio program devoted to garage rock and hosted by Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos, that was broadcast on a local radio station at 8 every Sunday morning. Best of all was listening to Little Steven, whether he was riffing on film noir, women, religion, rock rebellion, or the fate of the legendary CBGBs back home in New York. I never missed the show. I felt like it was keeping a part of my brain alive that would otherwise lie completely dormant. Even in prison, you had to work at being a nonconformist. I was a freak and an outcast, but in the underground garage, I always had a home out in the ether. Unless the weather was awful, I would usually listen while chugging around the track for the full 2 hours, often laughing out loud. It was like a lifeline that went straight to my ears.
Just one thing marred my ritual today, and that was LaRue, the nasty plastic surgery casualty from B dorm. LaRue was the only woman in the camp whom I flat out loathed. I did not hide my revulsion well, which was considered odd by my friends. She's a freak for sure, Piper, but no more so than some of these other wackos. It's weird how she gets to you. She was getting to me now. She was walking around the track in the center of the path, listening to what I assumed must be one of her fundamentalist radio shows, with her arms extended Christ-like and singing tunelessly in her high-pitched squeak about Jesus. Every time I lapped her, she remained smack in the middle of the gravel strip, arms spread wide. She was doing it on purpose, I was sure, to aggravate me and to force me off of the path. By the 10th time I passed her, my vision had stained red and I was boiling with focused fury. She was ruining little Stephen. She was ruining my run. I ground my teeth with hatred. On my 11th circuit, I watched her from across the oval, fantasizing her own crucifixion. I zoomed around the curve into the straightaway, gaining on her quickly. Her weird ass, fat with implants, remained in the center of the track. Her arms stayed pinned to her imaginary cross. And as I closed the distance between us, I raised my own hand and smacked one of hers down as I passed her. LaRue squawked in surprise and dove to the edge of the track, dropping her radio headset. A stream of Spanish invective followed me around the track. My heart soared for one moment and then immediately crashed. What the hell was wrong with me? What had I allowed this place to do to me? I couldn't believe I had raised my hand in aggression against another prisoner, especially this pathetic nut job. Shame washed over me. I stopped running, sick to my stomach. When I got around the track, LaRue was by the gym with one of the Spanish mommies I knew from work. I apologized awkwardly. "Francesca, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. Are you all right?" This was answered with another stream of irate Spanish. I got the gist. "Francesca, she said she was sorry. Let it go, mommy," advised my coworker. "She's fine. Just keep running, Piper." If you are a relatively small woman, and a man at least twice your size is bellowing at you in anger, and you are wearing a prisoner's uniform, and he has a pair of handcuffs on his belt, I don't care how much of a badass you think you are, you'll be fucking scared. One of the lieutenants was doing the bellowing, his mouth grim under his bristling mustache and crew cut. It had nothing to do with my smacking LaRue's imaginary stigmata on the track. I had been caught out of bounds in A-dorm by a renegade off-duty Mr. Finn, who turned up out of the blue on a night he wasn't even working and wrote shots for me and seven other out-of-bounds women, lining us up outside his office. This, in turn, earned each of us private FaceTime with the senior officer, who demanded to know if I disputed the charge, shot number 316 in the prison rule book. I said quietly that I did not and offered no excuse. This did not make him happy, and he growled, "Do you think this is funny, Kerman?" I sat perfectly still, not smiling. No, I didn't think any of this was the least bit funny, nor was I interested in jailhouse irony anymore. In the back of my mind, I knew he wasn't going to do shit to me. He wasn't going to put me in the SHU. He wasn't going to lay a hand on me. I wasn't going to lose my good time. It wasn't worth it to them to do the paperwork that would require. And he knew that I knew. Which was why he was screaming at me and scaring me, even though we both knew it was a totally pointless exercise. No, I didn't think it was funny. My out-of-bounds infraction was a minor one, a 300 series shot, along the same lines of refusing to obey a direct order, participating in an unauthorized meeting or gathering, failing to stand for count, giving or accepting anything of value to or from another inmate, possession of non-hazardous contraband, and indecent exposure.
Even lower on the list were the 400 series. Faking sick, tattooing or self-mutilation, conducting a business, or unauthorized physical contact, like hugging someone who was crying. More serious by far were the 200 series shots. Fighting, extortion, blackmail, protection rackets, wearing a disguise, engaging in or encouraging a group demonstration, work stoppage, bribery, stealing, demonstrating, practicing or using martial arts, boxing, wrestling or other forms of physical encounters, military exercises or drills, and the best known of all shots, the 205, engaging in sexual acts. The 100 series were the worst of all. You could catch another charge for them. Murder, assault, escape, possession of a weapon, inciting a riot, drug possession, and one perfect catch-all. Conduct which disrupts or interferes with the orderly running of the institution or the BOP. Eventually, the lieutenant stopped glaring at me and cast his eyes over to the bald man in the corner of the room. "Is there anything you'd like to add, Mr. Richards?" Certain prison guards relish the power and control that they wield over other human beings. It oozes from their pores. They believe it is their privilege, their right, and their duty to make prison as miserable as possible by threatening, withholding, or abusing at every opportunity. In my experience, these creatures weren't the sleazeballs who'd act sexually toward prisoners. In fact, they would never fraternize with lower life forms like us. And they reserved their most withering scorn for their colleagues who treated us humanely. Richards, also an enormous man, was a permanent shade of florid pink and kept his shaved head shiny. He looked like Mr. Clean's evil twin.
"Yeah, there is."
Richards leaned forward.
"I don't know what the hell has been going on up there, but we all know that the camp is off the chain. Will you go back up there and you tell your friends that I'm headed up there this new quarter and things are going to be completely different? You make sure you pass the word."
He leaned back in his chair, satisfied. All eight of us got the same speech. Of course we compared notes. My punishment was 10 hours of extra duty. I volunteered to work on the special overnight kitchen crew that was needed to produce Thanksgiving dinner. That way, I would get all 10 hours over in one fell swoop. Pop and the prison foreman she worked for, a well-liked guy whose office was full of plants, took holiday meals seriously. An extra-large team of women prepared turkey, sweet potatoes, collard greens, mashed potatoes, and stuffing, plus Natalie's pies. I was on POTS detail, clad in a rubber apron, giant rubber gloves, and a hairnet. We played the radio. I got a few tastes as we went, and everything was finished despite Pop's nervousness. She had only done it for 10 years in a row. We worked all night until the sun came up, and I felt pleasantly exhausted. This was the best way to be penitent, to pour my energy into the communal meal that we would all be sharing soon, even though most of us would rather be someplace else. Thanksgiving Day, I slept, had a visit with Larry and our friend David, and then ate my fill with Tony and Rosemarie. It was easily the best meal of the year. The feast was somewhat marred when the quiet Spanish mommy sitting next to me burst into tears in the middle of dinner and proved inconsolable. I always thought I was an Episcopalian. I didn't realize it, but I had really been raised to follow the ethos of Stoicism, the Greco-Roman answer to Zen. Many people on the outside, especially men, had admired my Stoicism when I was on my way to prison. According to Bertrand Russell, the virtuous Stoic was one whose will was in agreement with the natural order. He described the basic idea like this: in the life of the individual man, virtue is the sole good. Such things as health, happiness, possessions are of no account. Since virtue resides in the will, everything really good or bad in a man's life depends only upon himself. He may become poor, but what of it? He can still be virtuous. A tyrant may put him in prison,
but he can still persevere in living in harmony with nature. He may be sentenced to death, but he can die nobly, like Socrates. Therefore, every man has perfect freedom, provided he emancipates himself from mundane desires. Stoicism sure comes in handy when they take away your underpants. But how to reconcile it with one's insatiable need for other people? Surely my desire for connection, for intimacy, for human touch was not mundane. The very worst punishment that we can come up with, short of death, is total isolation from other humans. The supermax, seg, solitary, the whole, the SHU. The truth is, I was having trouble being a good Stoic. I couldn't resist life's emotional flow and pulse, or the imperfect people I found so vital. I kept on throwing myself into the current, although once in, I could usually stay calm and keep my head above water. Still, I had to wonder, why had my need to transgress taken me so far, to a prison camp? Perhaps I was just dense, unable to understand these things from a distance, but instead intent on scorching myself face to the fire, burning off my